The administration has made as much as $45 billion available for doctors and hospitals across the country to digitize medical records. Fewer than a fifth of our nation's hospitals and doctors currently use an electronic medical record system. This money is part of the government's stimulus plan and promises what amounts to a gold rush for major technology firms who have begun competing to win those accounts. But Fred Schulte, senior reporter for the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, says that some healthcare professionals wonder if the promise of electronic medical records has been exaggerated. He joins us in our studios. Fred, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Give us some idea how major companies are competing to win these accounts.
Well, there's, as you mentioned, a sort of a gold rush going on. There's a company that has a Cash for Clunkers inspired program where if you turn in your old equipment, they'll give you a discount on a new one. There's companies that are offering doctors interest-free loans if they buy, and you don't have to pay back any of the money until you get your check from the government. There's a stimulus tour. It's like a rock tour going around the country with a big bus convening doctors in groups and trying to sell them on the benefits of buying this equipment.
And there's some companies that with names that might surprise us that are getting into this market.
Well, some of the biggest companies in the world, Microsoft, Dell, Google. I mean, I think all of these huge tech companies are very interested in the billions of dollars that is going to derive from all these various types of healthcare and cyberspace. I mean, there's any number of things that will eventually come along once everything is digitized that there's cash registers ringing.
The stimulus plan promises money to doctors who make the switch, right? How does that work?
Well, it's not quite that simple. I mean, a doctor can get $44,000 in stimulus money for buying the equipment in his or her office, but you also have to make meaningful use out of it. Mm-hmm. That's what the law says, meaningful use, but the law doesn't define what meaningful use is. So the whole industry is waiting to see, and it should happen sometime early next year, what the government decides you have to do to be meaningfully using this equipment.
A lot of your reporting suggests that even at a time the government is pushing this initiative, there are some people in the healthcare industry who wonder if it isn't being oversold.
Well, there are many people that wonder just that. I mean, the studies are often conflicting about the benefits of it, and they're just a lot of people that think that the technology isn't quite there yet, that mm-hmm. the idea is great. And it's hard to find anybody that doesn't think that medicine needs to move into the modern age, into the computer age. But on the other hand, you have to make sure that the software doesn't do strange things and mix up patients and have other problems like that. And there have been cases of that. One of the problems that some of the critics are talking about is that nobody really is keeping track of the number of times that there's some sort of glitch or something goes wrong and whether those problems are causing injuries. Some of the critics want to see the federal government step in and begin requiring the companies that manufacture this equipment to report adverse reactions the same way that drug companies have to do.
Mm-hmm. And are there people concerned with some of the security implications?
Well, totally. The privacy issue is huge. I mean, as you move toward electronic medical records, one of the things that the government wants to do is set up a health internet so that medical information could be sent to doctors, hospitals, anywhere mm-hmm. in the world. And a breach of that security obviously could subject people's medical information to eyes that you don't want looking at it. So there's going to be probably years of trying to work out the privacy implications of going online like this.
Privacy implications being that doctor-patient relationship is considered inviolable, and there are people who are not doctors or, for that matter, patients of those doctors who might figure out a way to get access to that information.
That's true. And there's two issues, too. I mean, the first issue is who has control over the medical information in a medical record? And as we move to digital formats, it's not the same as a paper record being stored in a doctor's office. And many mm-hmm. consumer groups want to see patients actually have control of that information. Then if you send it across the internet, you want to be sure that it's being sent to somebody that you want it to be sent to and not being used for commercial purposes or some other thing that you don't want to see happen.
What are the implications for a hospital or a doctor to choose the right system?
They're huge because there's a lot of taxpayers' money involved, as you mentioned, some $44 billion. It's a very difficult choice to make because there are lots of different types of doctors with lots of different needs in their practice and lots of different equipment, and some of that equipment has a history of not working too well. Mm-hmm. A lot of doctors feel they're kind of at the mercy of these vendors and their salespeople that are coming out and not telling them, oh, this system is great and whatever, and then they go out and buy it, and then they have all kinds of bugs and problems with it. And the taxpayers obviously have a side in this because it's, if they collect the stimulus money, it's our money.
The hope is, isn't it, that competition brings down the price, stimulates innovation, and that's ultimately good for patients, consumers?
You mean for buying the equipment? Yeah. I mean, that would be the hope. But the critics are saying that when you go out and say, we're going to give you $44,000 to buy this, then the price is going to be $43,999. And there's not necessarily going to be a lot of incentive to get the prices down. Although some of the critics are saying there's a lot of new equipment coming onto the market that's much, much cheaper than that. And the taxpayers might save a lot of money if somebody decided which of these systems worked the best, and then everybody went with that.
Fred Schulte, senior reporter at the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Shortly after the Jewish New Year in 1743, a desperately poor but academically gifted young boy named Moses ben Mendel left the German village of Dessau and headed northwest to Berlin. After a few days trudging through the autumn mud, young Moses arrived to the Prussian capital.
Moses ben Mendel of Dessau found his way to the Rosenthaler Gate, where a representative of the Jewish community decided whether to allow him to remain. Now, most poor young Jews turning up there were given a bowl of soup, a place to sleep for the night, and then sent on their way the next morning. But when interrogated by the Jewish guardian of the gate, Moses of Dessau had the right name to drop, Rabbi Frankel. So the rabbi vouched for him, and he was allowed in. The gatekeeper's logbook for the day notes that at the Rosenthaler Gate, 6 oxen, 7 pigs, and 1 Jew entered the city.
That's Michael Goldfarb reading from his new book, Emancipation. It covers a period of time from the French Revolution to the early 20th century, during which Jews were granted full social and civil rights in most of Europe. Moses ben Mendel would eventually become the influential German-Jewish philosopher known as Moses Mendelssohn. He's one of dozens of European Jews profiled in the book, and many of you listening will, no doubt, recognize the voice of the author, Michael Goldfarb. For many years, he was NPR's correspondent in London. He's now an independent journalist and author, and Michael's with us. Great to have you.
Thanks, Guy. Glad to be here.
The story of Moses Mendelssohn is, in some ways, the story of how the Jews of Europe went from mostly living in ghettos to achieving incredible prominence in the arts and literature, academia, science, in a span of a few generations.
Yeah, it was a surprise to those who lived through it. The story really is about a people who had been ghettoized, legally segregated for the best part of half a millennium, and then overnight, effectively, were told, okay, well, now you can be French or now you can be German or whatever. And the process of coming out of this segregation and how it affected the community, but also how it affected the wider society.
Michael, tell me how the idea of Jewish emancipation came about. When did it begin?
Well, it grew sort of organically out of the political theorizing that underpinned the Enlightenment. As the Enlightenment went from its theoretical phase to its political phase with the French Revolution, there was the question of the Jews. What do we do with this religious and ethnic minority, or Jews were seen as an ethnic minority at the time, in our midst? And in France, where everything was up for discussion, people became, seems to me, kind of obsessed with the Jewish question. What do we do with them? Liberty, equality, fraternity. If all men are brothers, does that mean the Jews too? And the answer, as it was worked out in the constitution writing phase of the French Revolution, was yes. And the changes that came out of that were phenomenal.
And this is really the first time in European history when Jews are essentially emancipated.
Exactly right. There had always been business done, but now there was a challenge to their identity. And they were the first group, I think, in modern history to face, you know, questions that, you know, I think are part and parcel of the American experience for each new immigrant group that arrives. You know, am I an American? Am I Italian? Am I an American? Am I Mexican? We've invented the hyphenate. You're a Mexican-American. You're Jewish-American. In Europe, that wasn't quite the way things went.
As you write, this all really begins during the period of the French Revolution and then is sort of unleashed by Napoleon. What was his motivation? Why was Napoleon so interested in granting civil and social rights to Europe's Jews.
Initially, when Napoleon went off over the Alps into Italy, this is the first place he went outside France, he was bringing the ideals of the French Revolution to the peoples of Italy. By the time he became an egomaniac, motivations changed. And there's a conversation recorded by his physician on the island of St. Helena, where he was in exile, his final exile. He said, well, you did many good things for the Jews. Why? And he said, what I wanted them to do was regard France as their country, and I wanted to attract their talents to France.
Michael, there's a quote in your book from Isaac Disraeli. He was the father of Benjamin, who would go on to become the first and, I believe, only Jewish prime minister in Britain. He had already converted to Christianity at the time, but he was born Jewish. And Isaac Disraeli says that between the Babylonian exile and the time when Europe began to grant these rights to Jews, that he could count, this is a quote, all the Jewish men of genius or talent on his fingers. But then, of course, this starts to change rapidly at the end of the 18th century.
Yes, I think that what happened was unimaginable tensions. The first really great genius of the Emancipation era is Heinrich Heine.
The German poet
and author Heinrich Heine. Here was a man who was completely self-aware of his dilemma. He was a law student at the same time he was becoming the most famous young poet in the German language, because his family said to him, you know, well, look, you got to get a law degree because the writing thing may not last. And it was like, you know, as if Bob Dylan, when he was writing Blowin' in the Wind, was also going to NYU School of Law. It was a very weird time. When he finished his law degree, in order to practice law or to teach law, he had to be a Christian. And his family said, go ahead. It's all right with us. Convert. We know what's in your heart. Convert. Get the job.
And that was very common.
It was very common. And he resisted it for a long time. In the end, he did convert. And he spent the rest of his life regretting bitterly having done it. The point I'm making is that the tension between coming out of some way of life, very rigid, religious, looking inward life, and then suddenly not having that anymore, but not being accepted by the majority, was, for many people, almost impossible to bear. And Heine was blessed with talent to try and work things out through his writing. Other people did other things. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that so many of the early theorists of modern socialism and communism were Jewish. They came from the same social class as Heine, Moses Hess, Karl Marx, and so on, Ferdinand LaSalle. And they, too, wanted to reshape Europe so that the words of equality and fraternity were more than a slogan.
Michael Goldfarb is the author of Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Guy.
This week, NPR ran two related stories about hate crimes against immigrants. In Suffolk County, on the eastern half of Long Island, the number of Hispanics has increased 40% since 2000, and many immigrants say they're subjected to abuse and violence. NPR's justice correspondent Ari Shapiro traveled to Long Island for those stories and has this reporter's notebook.
The big secret about legal reporting is that the stories are easy to tell. In a court, two parties stand on opposite sides of an issue. The reporter just has to explain each side, and there's the story. So when I went to Long Island with producer Marisa Peñalosa to report on hate crimes, we expected to find two distinct groups of people, victims and perpetrators. Spanish-speaking immigrants had been attacked, spit on, and abused by employers and landlords. 1 year ago, an Ecuadorian man was stabbed to death, allegedly by seven local high school students. Marisa and I visited a hiring site for day laborers. About 100 men were drinking coffee and playing cards in a trailer. We asked them to tell us their stories. We met workers from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. One by one, they sat down and described their experiences as victims. They all wore baseball caps, and their hands were gnarled from years of hard physical work. Then a man who'd been eager to talk sat down. He wore a floppy tiger print hat over his baseball cap. He had sharp cheekbones and a puffy blue winter coat with fake fur lining the hood. With a shy smile, he introduced himself. He said, "My name is Jose Fuentes, but I go by Lorena because I'm effeminate. I'm gay." Fuentes took off his hat and parted his thick black hair. He showed us where doctors had put 7 staples in his head. He opened his mouth and pointed to where attackers had knocked out some of his teeth. We asked him, "Who did this to you?" "My problem is that there's a lot of violence within the immigrant community," he said. "Hispanics call me names, like queer. But," he said, "I'm not going to change. This is who I am." All of the immigrants we met struggle to get by day to day. One way they survive is by relying on each other. But Jose, or Lorena, said he is not safe even within his own community. For someone in his situation, there is no difference between the kinds of people who are victims of hate crimes and those who commit hate crimes. The men who are abused for being immigrants could easily be the same men who knocked out his teeth for being gay. Ari Shapiro, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Last month marked the 40th anniversary of what we now call the Internet. We continue our series, The Net at 40, this week with a look at an Internet relic, bulletin board systems, or BBSs. Born in Chicago in 1978, they would grow to number over 100,000 by the mid-1990s, only to be rendered obsolete by the World Wide Web. Just a few struggle on today. Producer Phil Harrell has this look back.
These were the original online social networks. Before Craig had his list, before friend was a verb, there were BBSs.
In this age of information, it is hard to ignore the fact that the number of personal computers is on the rise.
This 1992 instructional video said it all.
But most people are not aware of the possibility to connect their home computer to another in the outside world to share a vast resource of information and data.
The model for a bulletin board system is just like it sounds.
Tom Jennings was an early adopter of the bulletin board in the late 1970s.
It's the cork board in the entranceway to a supermarket. You know, you got a barbecue for sale, you put a 3x5 card with the description and your phone number, and you thumbtack it to the wall, and there's a whole collection of these things. It's a sort of a form of social commerce.
Tom Jennings went on to create something called FidoNet, which would revolutionize the way BBSs talk to each other. Sort of the first strands of the World Wide Web. Here's how it worked. Each individual BBS had its own phone number, usually run out of somebody's house. So a PC owner interested in connecting with that person's BBS would pick up the phone and dial in, and they'd be met with a rather rude answer. Then you'd quickly unplug the cord from the phone and jam it into the modem, and you're off. Before the BBS, the Internet was the exclusive domain of big business and big universities. All of a sudden, it was ours.
It was hobbyist-based. It was much more egalitarian. Any fool with $1,000 to put a machine together could be on the net. You did not have to go through layers of academic or corporate access. So bulletin boards were wild and woolly.
Tom Jennings saw the BBS expand from geeky computer talk, his words, not mine, to covering all sorts of different topics, sports, fantasy gaming.
Sex and relationships clearly has driven network communication since the start.
Hobbies, philosophies.
Just general birds of a feather kind of stuff, people who have similar interests.
BBSs opened up the world of computing to a generation that would go on to completely integrate computers into their lives. But by the mid-1990s, BBSs were obsolete, and their numbers took a nosedive. But believe it or not, there are still plenty around, even today. Most of them operate like any old website, but a handful of dial-ups are still out there. You can still dial in to a BBS, provided you've still got a modem.
My name is Michael Powell, and I run the Capital City Online BBS.
And he's been running it in one form or another since 1989.
It seems sort of a shame just to stop.
Michael Powell lives in Kentucky, where he says he spends about $13 a month to keep the phone line running and that extra computer powered up at all times.
As far as the actual dial-up goes, I might get two or three people a week, where it used to be you'd probably get that many in a two or three hours.
His BBS currently has conversations going on about the healthcare debate and politics and the sort of computer questions he always got back in the day. Most of his fan base went away with the advent of the World Wide Web.
Now, there is one person I still sometimes see his name out there. He still posts, and he was a user of mine back in the early 90s.
But these days, Michael Powell says, most of the people who come to Capital City Online do it just for the nostalgia value.
When I get a new caller that calls in dial-up, usually they'll compliment me on keeping it going and, still having it up the old-fashioned way. It's nice to know that they appreciate that, and it's nice that I'm still here to provide, that for them.
Powell says he has no plans to shut down his BBS, obsolete or not.
I've always said that if that particular computer I have it on, if it crashes, I might be hard-pressed to justify the cost of setting it up again. But so far, so good on that.
There's a website called BBS Corner that maintains a list of the remaining dial-ups in North America, 41 by their count, including Michael Powell and his Capital City Online, still making beautiful music together after 20 years. Phil Harrell, NPR News.
You can find that list of the remaining dial-up BBSs and other stories in our Net at 40 series at our website, npr.org.
A man should be careful talking about mammograms. But the report issued this week by a panel of doctors who recommended less frequent testing for breast cancer in women under 50 comes as Congress and the country debate health care coverage. Since the report came out, news accounts and blogs have featured hundreds of personal stories from women in their 40s who say, just this bluntly, that these new guidelines would have killed them by letting their cancer grow without detection. I know enough about mammograms to know they're not marshmallow treats. They're painful and humiliating tests that squash a woman where it hurts most. Most men, myself included, maybe even Daniel Craig included, would cringe to have a mammogram. And when the results are what they call false positive, a week or more of worry and anxiety follow along with a stinging biopsy. It's good news if nothing is found, but still, a punishing experience. I can understand why a lot of women would almost welcome a medical excuse to avoid an annual mammogram. The Washington Post ran a piece Friday by two physicians who worked with the doctor's task force, Douglas Camarot at Georgetown University and Stephen Wolfe at Virginia Commonwealth, defended their recommendation, noting that every 1,900 screenings in women ages 39 to 49 produced just one case in which cancer was discovered and arrested. They suggested that between bad results and biopsies, annual tests lead to a lot more worry and pain than cures. And yes, cost a lot of money that might be directed elsewhere. Of course, what if you are that one woman in 1900, or that one woman is your wife or mother? And if you screen just 1 million women between the ages of 39 and 49, statistics suggest you may catch cancer before it can grow in 526 women. Maybe we shouldn't be shocked, to think some doctors might find the chance to save one life in 1900 to be small result for so much effort. A lot of us play with our odds of survival by smoking, overeating, or talking on the phone while driving. People on all sides of the healthcare debate like to talk about how much money can be saved in their particular plan by reducing the number of medical tests that seem redundant or unnecessary. This week, we may have seen what happens when someone suggests a way to actually do that. A lot of people decide they can't live with that. You're listening to NPR News.
patient advocacy groups and cancer societies are pushing back hard against the recommendation made by a federal task force on breast cancer screening this past week. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force now says mammograms are unnecessary for women under the age of 50, and then only every 2 years. Dr. Marissa Weiss is an oncologist and the founder of breastcancer.org, and she joins us from Philadelphia. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Weiss, you have publicly expressed that you worry that these recommendations will have a devastating impact, particularly on African-American women. Why is that?
Yes. Well, because already African-American women experience this disease uniquely. They are more likely to get breast cancer under the age of 40. They are not utilizing the benefits of early detection as much as other women do. They have cancers that are tend to be more aggressive. For example, this cancer called triple-negative breast cancer that's about 2 to 3 times more common in African-American women, and that comes with a much more aggressive, life-threatening type of cancer. And so if these women, if they don't start getting their mammogram at age 40, then we will have missed the opportunity, I believe, to save their lives.
What about survival rates among women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, the differences between African-American women and Caucasian women?
Well, in the years between 1996 and 2004, for example, African-American women had a 77% survivorship, 5-year survivorship, compared to 90% among whites.
So what you're saying is that because African-American women are at higher risk of developing breast cancer, often under the age of 40, that the recommendations by the task force will be sending a message that they no longer should be screened until the age of 50, and that's the risk.
Yes, that's what I've been hearing this past week. We've seen a significant cancellation rate for mammograms at our hospital. And
because women are basically saying, well, I shouldn't do this until the age of 50.
That's right.
Dr. Weiss, there's significant evidence to show that among women who are screened, there's a disproportionate number of African-American women in this country who are not routinely tested. I mean, why will the task force recommendations change that anyway if this is already a problem?
Well, it's going to make the problem worse because doubt has been inserted for them to go out of their way now to get a mammogram when they may not have health insurance, to pay out of pocket for something that is of doubtful value from what they've heard this week will deter their coming forward and getting a mammogram.
Some of the loudest opponents of these recommendations have been radiologists. And some critics of these opponents have said, well, look, you know, radiologists have a stake in mammography. What do you say to folks who make that argument?
I understand that there's criticism that the strongest opponents of these revised guidelines are the people who make their living doing mammography. But the benefit of mammography has been demonstrated in clinical trials, both randomized clinical trials and population studies. So depriving women of the benefit of mammography punishes the women, not the doctors.
Dr. Marissa Weiss is an oncologist and the founder of breastcancer.org. Dr. Weiss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.